Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
And I'm joined in the studio now by An Tánaiste Dlí Ó Bhradacar, Minister for Enterprise, Trade and Employment, and Fine Gael TD for Dublin West. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Good morning. Very much.
The first thing I want to talk to you about is the breaking news this morning about that HSE review of the care of more than 1,300 children who attended the CAMHS, the Child and Adult Mental Health Services in South Kerry. And Barry Lenehan was in with us explaining that there was clear evidence in that review that 46 children suffered significant harm, 227 children were exposed to risk of significant harm through a junior doctor's diagnosis and treatment of them. Now, there are a number of recommendations in that report, but as we heard, the doctor seems to have acted without adequate supervision. It would appear to be the bottom line, and actual harm has been done to many children. And people will be asking this morning, how on earth has this been allowed to happen, and is it happening elsewhere?
Well, you know, I'm certainly very concerned about what I'm hearing, both as a public representative and as a doctor. And it does appear that, from what we're hearing anyway, is that children in Kerry were given medicine inappropriately, and that, that harm was done. Hopefully not permanent harm, but perhaps that was the case in some cases. So very concerned and very worried about what I'm hearing. I should say that I haven't seen the report yet, haven't been briefed on it. The way the open disclosure policy now works is that families are briefed first and get the report. So I haven't seen it yet, haven't read it yet, and Cabinet hasn't been briefed on it. But I'm sure the Minister for Health, Minister Donnelly, will want to do that in the very near future.
Would you have concerns, though, for other CAM services around the country, given that this happened over, it would seem, a four-year period and so many children were impacted?
Well, you know, there are a lot of children who avail of the CAM service, the Child and Adult Mental Health Services around the country, and I don't want to create unnecessary concern for them or for their parents. I'm not aware of anything similar being alleged in any other part of the country or being investigated in any other part of the country. But that's not to say that isn't the case. But I'm not aware of it. So, you know, I can at least give that reassurance to people, families who avail of that service.
There seems to be a structural problem here, because amongst the recommendations, they say we'll continue to do everything in our power to employ a permanent consultant to this service, though this has proved very difficult to achieve over the past number of years. I mean, it seems to be very clear, very blatantly obvious that it's an underinvestment problem, an under-resourcing problem feeding into this, that that key role still can't be filled despite this problem.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's as simple as that. You know, the budget now for mental health is over €1 billion a year. It's the highest it's ever been. I think it's gone up by about 20 or 30% only in the last couple of years. And as you'll know, our health budget is €22 billion now, one of the higher per head. Yeah,
but that's as may be, but it would seem almost impossible to attract somebody into that job.
Yeah, and that isn't always about money and always about resources. It can be difficult to recruit consultants and healthcare staff in certain specialties, in certain parts of the country. It's very much an employee's market in the health service, and this isn't a problem by any means unique to Ireland, that there's a very much a global shortage of well-qualified professional healthcare staff. Every country is competing for them. They do tend to want to work in the big centres in the big cities, and that creates huge difficulties for us in recruiting and retaining high-quality staff in more peripheral locations, no matter how much resources our salary we offer, for example.
I want to move on and talk about remote working now, because we're getting a lot of response and reaction to this morning from our listeners. Who would be an employer, says this person in Wexford, in Ireland nowadays? Employees have a right to work from home. It's a joke. Employees should be given the opportunity at interview that is office based, and then they can take it or leave it. This government is pandering to Sinn Féin and trying to buy votes.
Well, I suppose it's always the way in politics, is when you're being criticised from both sides, it means you might just about be getting things about right. But like I say, what I published yesterday was the heads of the bill, the proposals for the new right to request remote working. That will now go to the Oireachtas Committee. The committee will have hearings. I'll be interested to hear what they have to say, interested to hear what the unions have to say, what the employers bodies have to say. Mm-hmm. And I'll take on board suggestions from all sides to improve the legislation. But it's important not to forget what the intention is here behind this. It's one of five new employment rights that I'm creating this year, including the new public holiday, additional redundancy rights for people laid off in the pandemic, statutory sick pay, and also the protection of tips and gratuities. There is currently no legal right to remote working. or even to request it. This is a new additional workers' right, and it's important that we get the balance right. Yeah, and it's something I do want to encourage. You know, there are a lot of advantages in remote working, and it's something that government wants to encourage, provided the business is done and provided public services are not diminished.
So we've the right to ask for it, but just this list of 13 grounds for the employer to refuse the request to work from home, it does seem very weighted in favour of the employer. Where is the employee voice here?
Well, at the moment, there is no employment right around this. So we're creating an employment right. Some people already have remote working, home working in their contracts. This is for people who don't, who were not hired on the basis that they're allowed to remote work at all, but were required to during the pandemic. And I want to move that from a requirement to a choice. A lot of people want to do blended working, sometimes in the office, sometimes at home, sometimes in a hub in a rural area. I want to promote that and facilitate that. And this gives somebody who has no contractual right at all at the moment to work remotely or from home. Once they're 6 months in employment, they can request remote working. Within at least 12 weeks, the employer has to consider it and come back with a reasoned response, can say yes, can say no, or can make a counter proposal, you know, which might accept some of the, you know, some of what's being asked for. If they say no, they have to give a stated reason, and that can be appealed and ultimately can go to the WRC. Okay. And I should say, it may not be clear from the documents that were released yesterday, that this isn't just a procedural right. You know, the employer will have to give a good reason, and that reason will have to stand up. It can't just be a box-ticking refusal, if that makes sense.
But Patricia King makes the point there that the employer can say, I have planned structural changes coming down the track, so I refuse your request based on that grounds here as cited in the heads. And that's it. That's the end of it, because she's saying you can't appeal that. You can only appeal on some technical point, like the answer didn't come back within the 12-week period, for example.
Yeah, and I can understand why she's saying that, but these are the heads, not the bill. And in the bill, it's going to be clear that it's not just a case of it's not just a procedural right, if you like. It's not just the case of the employer being able to tick one of those 13 boxes.
So the employee could appeal based on a refusal on one of these grounds?
Yes, but it will have to be, you know, there'll be an onus on the employer to show that this is, you know, that this is a real ground. But let's not forget the most important grounds here. And, you know, a lot of people, I hear some people in the opposition saying that an employee should have the, you know, automatic right to remote working. You know, that's not practical. There are lots of jobs that can't be done remotely, you know, construction, retail, hospitality, most of healthcare. So we need to be realistic about that as well. There can't be an absolute right. There do have to be qualifications.
Yeah, well, we had Louise O'Reilly from Sinn Féin on the programme yesterday, and that was the first thing that she said, that they recognise that, you know, there are many jobs that can't be done remotely.
And there are also some jobs that in theory could be done remotely. Say, for example, a college lecturer in theory could do all tutorials and all lectures online, but that would result in a diminished education experience for the students. So, you know, we have to bear that in mind as well. But the basic principle that I would apply is that provided the business can be done and provided that public services or services to the public are not diminished, well, then the employer should say yes. And this new right is designed to tip the dial, make it more likely for an employer to say yes and less likely for them to say no.
This strategy, this bill, you're saying it's not finished. You're open to having it changed, amended.
Oh, yeah. And that's the stage that we're at now. This is the heads of the bill. So we've done a public consultation already, heard very good participation in that. This now goes to the Joint Oireachtas Committee, and I will take seriously proposals for amendments. I haven't seen any yet, but if the opposition parties want to put down amendments, I'm happy to look at them. And there will be an engagement, of course, a further engagement, of course, with the unions and with the employers. But as is always the case, you do need to get the balance right here. You know, like one of the grounds for refusal, for example, is around data protection and privacy. You know, none of us would like the idea of somebody working from their kitchen with our private data on their laptop that anybody in the house could read. You know, so there are serious issues here. And we need, you know, ironically, because people were forced to work from home all of a sudden in the pandemic, a lot of those things weren't teased out. And now we are going to have to tease them out. But I'm up for that.
OK, and Richard Grogan, the employment lawyer, says that legislation will have to change to reflect the fact that if you have an accident while working from home, that's your problem. Do you agree with him?
Well, there's a big fear that employers have around that, by the way, is that if somebody is working from home and, you know, they trip over their own chair or trip over their own desk, they can then potentially sue the employer. And that's the reason why employers may not want to allow someone to work from home. And I think that's a problem. So that's something we're going to have to work out. But that would actually be a whole separate area. That's personal. That's personal injury legislation.
Okay. And do you see this strategy as being part of the green strategy, in that people may not have to commute as much, therefore they will be causing less admissions or emissions? I think you said if someone moves to Mayo, for example, and has to come to Dublin twice a week, they'd actually be doing more harm than if they were in Dublin 5 days a week and commuting a shorter distance.
Yeah, but potentially. I think there are huge benefits in this, by the way, for regional development, for rural development. I think this is actually good for business in the round, because it'll help them to recruit and retain staff. I think it can be good for families in terms of work-life balance. I think it can be good for people with disabilities, perhaps being able to access jobs that they weren't able to access before. The environmental one is... That does honestly depend. There is, and we're going to do some research on this through the NTA. Of course, people working from home means that they're travelling less traffic. That's good, potentially reduced emissions. But as you pointed out yourself, if somebody who currently lives in suburban Dublin commutes into the city centre 5-10 kilometres a day, if they were to move, let's say, to East Mayo and were to commute 200 kilometres once a week, their emissions would actually rise. Yeah. So it's not in environmental terms, I don't think it's a slam dunk, but in other terms, certainly in terms of helping people with disabilities get into the labour market, helping parents stay at work, return to work sooner, work life balance, more time with the kids. All of those things, traffic, the benefits outweigh the downsides by a mile. And that's why we're promoting this. And it's not just about the legislation. It's about the connected remote hubs that are being set up all over the country, about 150 of them. Would ask anyone to go on to connectedhubs.ie, check out that website. You can book a desk for 2 days' time if you want to. It's easier than booking a restaurant at the moment. Invest into the National Broadband Plan, all these things tied together.
And how does this then dovetail with the right to disconnect? Because you're committing to that too. Because people who are remote working, they might take the opportunity to take a couple of hours off in the afternoon to deal with children or other commitments, and then come back and work later on in the day. So how does this all fit together?
Well, the right to disconnect has been done already. It's a code of practice that's been produced by the Workplace Relations Commission and is admissible in labour disputes. So that was done a couple of months ago. But one thing I think is important to appreciate, and I think most people will, the best way to work out these things is in a practical way at workplace level. We've seen how successful home working and remote working can be. Employers know that they're finding it hard to recruit and retain staff. You know, it makes sense for employers and their staff to sit down and make arrangements that work for them. The law can only do so much. And what we're trying to do here really is to create a framework for those who don't currently have any right to remote working to seek that right and have some recourse if their employer doesn't try to facilitate them.
Mm. What about the rights of the employer, though, if they are dealing with somebody who has been less productive while working from home? Does this put them in an even trickier position trying to work with that person if they're applying for, you know, a remote working bump, if you like, in their contract, and there's a performance issue? How does that work for the employer? We're getting a lot of messages from employers, by the way.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, and it's always a challenge when you create any of these new rights. You'll have people who say you're not going far enough, and you'll have people saying you shouldn't be doing this at all. One of those grounds that you mentioned is around productivity. So it is reasonable for an employer to say back to an employee that we can facilitate remote working or home working for you, but you still have to meet your KPIs, you still have to meet your sales targets, you still have to process as many permits as you would otherwise. So that is one of the grounds.
Okay, and moving on then to other issues in the news. Headlines in the Irish Independent saying the boom is back. The St. Vincent de Paul is saying that is asking the government to take radical steps to deal with child poverty. And they've suggested this child poverty unit, which is a cross-government initiative. I think they use the example of New Zealand, where it covers housing and education and transport and energy, and indeed your own department as well. Would you commit to something like that, or to a child poverty unit?
Yeah, we're certainly give a commitment to give it full consideration. I can't make that commitment on behalf of the government.
But, do you concede that child poverty is an issue now with rising inflation?
It's absolutely an issue and has been an issue for quite some time. And thankfully in Ireland, over the past five or so years, poverty has gone down and child poverty has gone down, and inequality as measured by the Gini coefficient has reduced. And we're one of a few countries in the world where poverty has been falling and inequality has stayed the same or reduced. But that's not to say that those things don't exist. Child poverty is real. And there are a number of factors involved in that. Issues around welfare, issues around housing, issues around parents, particularly single parents, being able to access the labour market. And we do have a national social inclusion strategy that sets out what we want to do.
Well, you know, it's an issue right now because you're committing to this €113 or so kickback from your fuel bills, which I think March is the date when that's coming along. But the Labour Party have said this is tokenistic and insulting, and it won't solve many problems for many people, will it?
It certainly won't on its own, but it's not the only thing the government is doing. And I do want to acknowledge, by the way, that inflation is very high at the moment, that the cost of living is rising, and that for a lot of families, that's really squeezing household budgets, particularly for lower income families, sometimes having to choose between paying the ESB bill or filling the car and the weekly shop. You know, so it's very, very tight for a lot of people. You'll remember back in June, I was in the studio and I was advocating for a welfare increase for a pension package and a tax package in the budget, precisely because I'd identified and my party identified that inflation and was going to be an issue and the cost of living was going to rise. At that time, some people said middle-income people didn't need any more money and they opposed tax cuts, particularly those on the left. Other people said I was being profligate, by suggesting that there'd be a welfare and pension package. I'm glad we did that now. We won the argument for that in the budget. That's kicking in this month. People will see an improvement in their payslips this month because of the income tax reductions. Pensions have gone up. Welfare goes up, has gone up as well this month. We have the freeze on childcare fees. We have the 2% maximum increase in rent. We have the €100 energy credit. I accept that on its own, even altogether, probably isn't going to be enough. One thing we'll need to see as well is pay increases across the economy. We had an increase in the minimum wage, again, just kicked in the last few weeks. There will need to be negotiations about further pay increases at workplace level. That's going to need to happen. And we'll need to do other things. One thing I really want us to do as a government is to reduce the cost of childcare. Ireland is an outlier in terms of the cost of childcare, and that really hits family budgets.
You mentioned pay increases. You want employers to increase wages. Is that what you're saying?
Where they can afford to, of course. And they are doing that. You know, we saw last year a 7% increase in the income tax take, not because we increased income taxes, we didn't, but because pay is rising and there's more people at work. Now, it's not the case that everyone in every workplace is getting a pay rise. I get that.
Some people get left behind.
Unfortunately, to a certain extent, that will always be the case. You know, it's never going to be the case that everyone is able to get the same pay rise in the same workplace. It does depend on the circumstances.
Is it really a strategy, though, to say to employers, will you please increase wages to help us deal with this problem?
It has to be part of the solution. You know, we haven't had much inflation for a long time in Ireland, but it's not new, and it's something we would have experienced in the past. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why we increased welfare, pensions, reduced income tax, increased the minimum wage only in the last couple of weeks is to help respond to inflation. And I think pay rises have to be part of that. But of course, they have to be affordable.
And do you accept the criticism from the Labour Party that energy rebate, the €113, is tokenistic?
I think if it was the only thing we were doing, I'd accept it. But it's not the only thing we're doing. You know, we had the increase in the fuel allowance, for example, for those on the lowest incomes. We have decreases in personal taxation, which the Labour Party opposed and Social Democrats opposed too. And last week they were saying didn't go far enough. You know, so that's the irony of the criticism sometimes.
Well, look, on energy, there's a danger, isn't there, that the tensions on the Ukraine-Russia border, that they're going to worsen inflation when it comes to energy prices. The central bank is warning just this morning that the gas prices could rise even further in the event of a Russian invasion in Ukraine. So this problem could potentially get much worse.
It could, which I think is one of the reasons why we really need to see a de-escalation in tensions. The gas that we use in Ireland comes about half from the Carb gas field, which is our own gas, and most of the rest from the UK, Qatar and Norway. So we're not reliant on Russian gas supplies at all. But if they were cut off, there would be a knock-on impact. Mm-hmm. gas prices on the wholesale market would rise and rise further. And that's a concern.
Yeah, and not just when it comes to energy, because the central bank is warning that any military conflict there could have wider effects on the Irish economy, on sentiment and on growth.
Yeah, and it could. And this is in nobody's interest that there should be conflict or war in Europe. We're a small country. We only have so much influence over these things. I don't think people in the Kremlin are necessarily worried about what our response is going to be, but we do have influence.
Well, they're interested
through the European
enough
Union
in us now to carry
Nations.
Out their missile tests off the southwest coast. What do you make of that?
I don't think that's aimed at us. It may well be a show of strength towards Britain and France. I don't think that's particularly aimed at us.
It's been said, hasn't it, that they've identified this weak spot when it comes to European waters, and they've said we'll do this. Could be an act of provocation, might not be, but it certainly looks as though it's strategic, doesn't it?
It's certainly unwelcome, and the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, has communicated that very clearly to the Russian ambassador. The Russians are not breaking any law because it's happening in international waters, but it's happening very close to our coast.
And the ambassador said that was overblown, wasn't it, the concerns?
Well, the argument that the Russians would make is that they do these exercises in international waters every year, and that this is just a coincidence. But whether it's a coincidence or not, at a time of increasing tensions, at a time of real concern around a possible war between Ukraine and Russia, we think that they should call them off, and that would demonstrate goodwill, that the Russians do want to de-escalate these tensions.
What do you say to the Irish fishermen who are saying that they plan a peaceful protest on that day?
Well, always respect the right to peaceful protest for a start, but we'll just remind them that these are military vessels. These are huge ships. They're much bigger than fishing trawlers, and this is a live fire exercise. And I'd say, by all means, go ahead with the protest exercise, your right to protest if you feel that's necessary. But please be careful, because these are military vessels.
It's interesting what the Russian ambassador said about these plans, the fishermen's plans. Any attempts to intervene would be reckless and irresponsible, which could put in harm's way both sailors and fishermen. Now, there's several ways you could interpret that, and one of them is that is a threat, is it?
I didn't hear what he had to say in full or in context. But from what the section you've read out to me sounds a little menacing. But like I say, I didn't hear that in full and in context.
Okay.
But I don't think the Russians are going to want to create an incident involving civilian vessels either. But like I say, I'd caution fishermen to take care.
Yeah, well, and the fishermen say that you, in saying that, are not supporting them, and you're not being strong enough against what the Russians are doing. Patrick Murphy from the Irish South and West Fish Producers Organisation said, "How's that for standing up for fishermen? I'd describe them, the government, as jellyfish with no backbone. Did you fail to stand up for the fishermen in telling them to take care?"
No, I think it's good advice. This is the Russian Navy. This is a major military power with nuclear weapons, with submarines. Let's not be naive about that.
You were. It was reported over the weekend that your legal representatives have been in touch with the Gardaí to ask when the investigation into you might be completed. Did you get an answer from the Gardaí?
Not a definitive answer. I understand that it is nearing a conclusion, but I've heard that before, so I don't know if that's going to be the case. You know, all I can say, Claire, is what I've said before, is that I first heard about this investigation through the media around this time last year, cooperated fully, was interviewed, answered all questions, provided devices and documents, have heard nothing since.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, I'd be keen to have it concluded as soon as possible, but I can't interfere in the investigation in any way, and there's nothing I can do to force the pace of it. So I just hope that it will be concluded soon.
Mm-hmm. And your legal representatives have spoken to the Gardaí, but you haven't heard from the Gardaí since they made their inquiries and spoke to you directly. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I've heard nothing at all since April.
Because, you know, it's been said many times over the last number of weeks that this could impact the transition when you go back into the Taoiseach's office if you're still under investigation. I mean, clearly you would agree that it would impact that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be asking for this to be clarified and completed.
That's not the reason. You know, this is an investigation that's gone on for a very long time now, and that's why I'd like it to be concluded. I think others would too, even my critics and my opponents politically were saying it's gone on for a long time, and that was back in August. Sinn Féin and Social Democrats were saying that that had gone on for a long time. But you know, I want to restate that, you know, the allegations that have been made against me are false.
Is that not for the Gardaí to decide?
Well, it's not actually. It's for the DPP to decide whether I have a case to answer or not. And if I've no case to answer, I've no case to answer. If I do have a case to answer, well, then it would be a matter for the courts. But you know, I'm confident. I'm sure we won't get to that point because I know that these allegations aren't true. You know, the suggestion that I've done anything criminal or corrupt or even self-interested is totally wrong. And I set out all of the facts in the Dáil in November. 2020 at this stage, and nobody has produced evidence to the contrary.
All right, we await to hear from the Gardaí as to where that's going to go. Just one final question on the controversies in Downing Street. We're awaiting the report of this of Sue Gray, the senior civil servant, is looking into the Boris Johnson party allegations. If he does lose his job, if he's forced out, how do you think that impacts the Northern Ireland Protocol negotiations?
Well, you know, I don't know what's going to happen in British politics.
But can he survive it, do you think?
I honestly don't know. And, you know, it's best for me not to comment on internal affairs in another country. Whatever happens, we will deal with whoever the Prime Minister is, whoever the Foreign Secretary is. We've seen lots of changes of personnel. You know, David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, different Brexit secretaries, different foreign secretaries. No matter who holds those positions, we'll try to build a relationship with them. We'll work with them. And that's what that's our job, essentially, as representatives of the Irish people. And that's what we'll do. And we're not going to interfere in the internal politics of another country.
OK, Tánaiste, thank you very much for joining us. We'll be hearing more about that Downing Street report after the break.